Dr. Smith, thank you for joining me with this breaking news, especially. I think this just took a lot of people by surprise, Ian, because we've all bumped our heads and gone to bed, but we've never imagined we could die.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting concept, and you learn it, you know, in your third year of medical school when you talk about brain contusions, which is basically, you know, what can happen, but also bleeding in the brain. And so, obviously, just I haven't seen the medical report, but according to what's been reported in the media, he probably hit his head, didn't think much of it, went to sleep, and ended up dying. Now, the reason why this happens is because you can have a very slow hemorrhage or brain bleed. And so you hit the back of your head, the blood vessels in your head, you know, may tear, and which causes bleeding into the brain. And then there's a covering over the brain that protects the brain. It's called the dura mater. And what happens is the blood gradually increases. And because the dura mater or the skull can't move much, you can imagine the blood is collecting and it starts pressing against the brain because there's nowhere for the blood to escape. And so the buildup of the blood pushes the brain. And over a period of time, if the brain is not relieved of the pressure, you can actually die. And that's what it sounds like it happened here. There's two things. It's called a subdural hematoma, which means that, let's say this is the covering of the brain. Here's the brain. This is the covering of it here. In between this space is called the subdural space, and the blood can grow there and then impinge on the brain, or the blood can accumulate on top of the dura between here and the skull, and that can also press on the brain. So we don't know if he had a subdural hematoma or an epidural hematoma. Either way, it caused brain problems, which led to his death.
I think for anybody watching, they sort of wonder, well, how bad a bump, you know, could it be if I need to worry about going to the doctor instead of going to bed? I mean, does it have to be a significant hit where you see stars and you really, I mean, you get your proverbial bell rung? Or how? I just wonder, how can we know that this might not happen to us? We bump our heads all the time.
Yeah, well, this is the confusion, and this is why it's very tricky. Natasha Richardson, the wife of Liam Neeson, who died at 45 from a ski accident in Canada, had a situation where she hit the back of her head on the snow. She felt fine. She refused medical advice. She walked back to her hotel room, and hours later, she was in a coma. And so you don't know how bad the hit has to be, but there's some symptoms you should look out for. Number one, if you have confusion, if you have a headache, if you have vomiting, nausea, those are signs that something could be progressively getting worse. Now, I remember as a little boy, when we played sports, if you hit your head, they would always say to your parents, keep them up, keep them awake, keep them awake. Well, the reason why they used to say to keep you awake is to see whether or not any symptoms developed or if they worsened. If you're awake, you can say, oh, I'm getting more confused, or my head is hurting more, or I'm feeling nauseous. And that's why when someone has any type of head trauma, don't let them go to sleep right away. Keep them awake to see if the symptoms develop or if they get worse.
It's just so sad, Dr. Ian. I'm going to ask you to stick around if you can, Ian, because I've got a whole other story that I want you to weigh in on. A woman that the state of Texas says was unfit to be selling fitness. So we'll come back to you in just a little bit. Dr. Ian Smith is going to be back in just a moment. First, though, I want to take a turn to a legal test and the question of why a single mother of five was arrested and charged with reckless conduct. The fact pattern's kind of curious, to say the very least. I'm not going to lie here. Back in May of 2020, at the height of the pandemic, Melissa Henderson, seen here with her kids, went back to work because, you know, she was told to, like so many of us. But the daycares were still shut down and the schools were still, you know, keeping every kid at home doing remote learning. And she didn't quite know what to do with the five kids. So she decided to leave her 14-year-old daughter in charge of the other four young siblings. But then, while that 14-year-old was online learning herself during the school day, her 4-year-old little brother left the house and walked over to visit a little neighborhood pal. He was gone for about 10 to 15 minutes. And you can see the house across the way there to the right, on the right side of those trees, down the stairs and straight over there. It's, you know, within eye shot. So 10 to 15 minutes later, his big sister realizes he's gone. She marches right over to that neighbor's house to retrieve her little brother. But that was apparently too long. 10 to 15 minutes, it was too late. The neighbor had already called the police. When the 14-year-old explained everything to the officers who arrived, it seemed at first no harm, no foul, because the police even said in a report that they felt the teenager was perfectly capable of taking care of her siblings. And they took down mom's info and they went on their way. But then 2 weeks later, the police noticed that this was not the first time that the 4-year-old had been outside unattended. At least one other time that year, the police had been called when the boy was outside alone. And so the police returned. And with the kids right there at home, they arrested the mother and charged her with criminal reckless conduct. Melissa Henderson was taken to jail, where she was then bailed out by her ex-husband. Henderson is still fighting the charge 2 years later and faces a maximum penalty of a year in prison and a $1,000 fine. So back to that original question. What part of what she did could be considered illegal, reckless conduct? If you're having a tough time figuring it out, you are not alone. I am joined now by Melissa Henderson herself, the single mom who found herself in the middle of this legal fight. She's also joined by her attorney, David DeLugas. Thank you to both of you for being here tonight. Okay, so Melissa, when I first heard this, I sort of thought, heavens to Betsy, a 14-year-old. I was babysitting at 12. I didn't quite understand, but what went through your mind when the police showed up?
Honestly, I was surprised. They actually were there the day that they called the police. They waited for me to get home from work just to tell me that, you know, it was not a big deal. They just wanted me to know, you know, everything was fine and no big deal. And then a week later, they came back and told me I was going to be arrested. So what went through my mind was just shock.
I would imagine. And so obviously you call David, your lawyer. David, you show up in the picture. I'm looking at the Georgia statute here. The Georgia Department of Human Service even has guidelines. But it says that kids who are 13 years or older can look after siblings for up to 12 hours. And Melissa's daughter's 14. So I'm trying to figure out where the statute was broken.
Well, it wasn't. That's just plain and clear to me and to anybody who looks at the facts. The reckless conduct statute actually was held unconstitutional by the Georgia Supreme Court in 1997 under similar facts where an 11-year-old took care of a 5-year-old and tragically the 5-year-old was killed and the mother was charged because she had left the younger child with the older child. And the Georgia Supreme Court said, whoa, 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 this statute doesn't give parents any heads up or warning that they can't do this, have an older child take care of a younger one. And on top of that, we don't want law enforcement to have so much discretion that they can just decide what is and what isn't reckless and charge anybody at any time for literally anything such as this. And that was 1997. So I was astonished when I learned that a warrant had been signed for her arrest. And before they arrested her, I got in touch with the deputy sheriff, the district attorney's office, and the magistrate judge and said, hey, here's this 1997 case. Take a look at it before you arrest her, please. They arrested her anyway.
That didn't happen. Well, they arrested her. They put her in jail. Her ex-husband had to bail you out, Melissa. Okay, a couple things I want to, you know, get to the bottom of here. The reports say that your little guy, I think he was 4 years old, was naked from the waist down, that the neighbor saw a storm coming and said, oh, heavens, brought the little guy inside for safety and gave him pants. And then for whatever reason, after 10 minutes, decided to call the police. She said to, I think, you know, maybe let them know where the boy was. But it had happened before, and the police said that they had warned you a year prior, like, you can't do this or you could get in big trouble. So the critics, of what you did would say, well, there you go. The police told you and you should have been arrested. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, the police can tell you not to do something, but if it's not illegal, it's not illegal. Just letting your child be outside. Yes, he went outside that day without his pants on, but he's a 4-year-old little boy. He was probably just took them off.
Oh, I think we're losing your audio. Darn it, Melissa. Oh, rats. Melissa, I don't know if you can hear me, but we're losing your audio. So I'm going to get your camera person to help you out with the audio. Can we hear you now?
Okay.
Oh, now I can. I actually She can't know. Okay. It's bad. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. So we were at the point where your little four-year-old, you know, whips his pants off and what little kid doesn't. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yes, he went outside the year before, but they didn't see any problems then. They even told me there was literally no issue and then that it happens. The same thing they told me when he went outside the second time and he was going outside to play with the neighbor boy who was already outside himself by himself.
So there's, Melissa, there's one other neighbor who weighed in and gave a police report saying that there was another time when the little guy and another little sibling, they were in electric cars and they were flying down towards where the traffic got a lot busier and that they were really worried at the time. So it sounds like a couple of the neighbors had concerns. Wow. And the police themselves said it was more that the 14-year-old, they felt shouldn't have been given all that responsibility day after day while you were at work. Did you feel at any point like, gosh, leaving a 14-year-old who's got a full day of school with four little siblings might have been too much for her?
You know, honestly, no. She was very prepared for everything. She knew what she was doing. Everybody can turn their back at some point and little ones sneak out the door. Playing outside was not an issue in that area. There was no road. It's a cul-de-sac where tons of the neighborhood kids are constantly playing unattended. They ride their bikes. They play football. They play basketball. They're playing in the yard, riding their little motorized cars, all the kids all the time. So for mine to be outside as well was no different than theirs. Everyone's just kind of usually congregated up playing right there. It's not traffic. The neighborhood.
I've turned my back and I've had, listen, I get you.
I never even met.
Little guys, my boys took off all the time. And I mean, I was a hawk and I still couldn't keep track of them. The prosecutors offered you, I got 1 minute left, Melissa, but the prosecutors offered you a deal, 20 mm-hmm. hours of community service and parenting classes, and they dropped the charges. You said, no way, Jose. So you got a court date coming up. Are you worried about what might happen?
You know, I'm just going to take each day as it comes because you can't let things weigh on you like that. But, you know, I just don't feel that was right. So I'm not going to take the plea. I don't feel that I did anything wrong. So I just feel that things should, you know, get down to where they understand that as well.
So Melissa Henderson and David DeLucas, thank you. I want to have you both back. I want to follow this case and see what happens. I sure appreciate you taking the time tonight, 10 o'clock at night, to do this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I'm going to go into the dispassionate zone. Brad Micklin is a family law attorney. Dr. Charles Sophie is a psychiatrist and the former medical director of the County of Los Angeles Department of Children and Family Services. And the two of them together know a thing or two about the very nature of this story. Brad, let me begin with you. You heard the fact pattern. You know the Georgia statute. I'm trying to figure out where police and a DA, but as I understand it, it was an ADA, an assistant DA, figured they had this in the bag and that they should charge her and march right up to her house with five cruisers and put her in the back of the car and take her to jail.
Yeah, I think it's appalling how this played out. This is not just a question of how old is the babysitter supposed to be. It's a question of the state's right and ability to limit your constitutional right to parent your children. Here, this is just about punishment. They swarmed in, they arrested her in front of her children because she left her daughter, who I understand was a 4.5 GPA student, a varsity track star, certified in CPR. She even took Red Cross classes on parenting. We should all be fortunate to have children that are that responsible. And to be arrested in front of them and prosecuted for this crime is just simply appalling.
Well, and in front of all the neighbors, too. I mean, it was so palpable that one of the neighbors called the police to say, oh, my God, I saw these cop cars in the neighborhood. What, is everything okay? So clearly it was a show of force for this. I don't know. She's probably like weighs about $1.15, you know, this mom. Okay. So the question, Dr. Sophie, I have for you is the initial police report that the responding officers gave said that that 14-year-old daughter was capable of taking care of the siblings while the mother is at work. They felt at the time it was an isolated incident. They learned later it wasn't, which is why they re-upped and came back and said, okay, wait, this is happening too much. Now we have to go after you. The poor 14-year-old's got school and she shouldn't be looking after four little kids. But the big question for everybody watching right now, whether you're a parent or a grandparent, it's not really about age. It's about the capability, correct, of your kid, if you want your kid to look after kids?
I can't hear.
Oh, Dr. Sophie, you can't hear me? Rats. Okay, while we fix Dr. Sophie's IFB, the gremlins are with us tonight. I can't believe it. Brad, I'm going to get you to jump in again on that question, legally speaking, because I went state to state. And I'm going to put up a graphic if I can. And this is from the National Safe Kids Campaign. This is what all the recommendations are for these states. For what age of child can be left alone? No babysitter. Home alone. California, age 12. Delaware, age 12. Georgia, age 8. Kansas, age 6. Michigan, age 11. Mississippi, age 12. North Dakota, 9. Oklahoma, 6. South Dakota, 10. And Washington, 10. Those are the ages you can be alone without a sitter. So, Brad, the laws don't specify a certain age where it becomes illegal to leave your kids with their older sibling. It just is at the discretion, it seems, of the responding officers. That just seems like a legal quagmire for a lot of people.
You're right, and it's not even a question just for the arresting officer. In all child welfare cases, there's a choice between protecting a family and prosecuting a family, and they're separate and distinct systems. So in many states, for instance, police officers are required to contact protective services when they find that there's a risk of harm to children, and that system comes out, investigates, and puts services into place to help the family. Then we have a criminal system that prosecutes for crimes and punishes. That's the one that we're using here. The offer about parenting classes and all of that through the criminal system could and should have been offered through what would be considered a civil or governmental system, like a child protective services, where if they thought she had an issue with maybe a bad judgment call or her children weren't capable, then they should have put services in place to help the family, to protect them, not to prosecute them.
Well, originally they did put a plan, you know, in place with the first incident, but it expired, you know, and so she wasn't in any infraction of any plan that had been put in place because it had already lapsed. And they talked about doing it again, but ultimately you saw, you know, what happened. Okay, Dr. Sophie, I think you can hear us now. I had originally asked about, you know, one person's 12-year-old is not even the same as someone else's 15-year-old. I mean, the 12-year-old can often be more responsible than a 15-year-old, and maybe that's why the law doesn't codify where you've really gone wrong. But I just can't seem to shake the idea that I was a latchkey kid, and so was my brother. And many of us in the 60s and 70s came home, made our lunches, and went back to school, and all the while were unattended around knives and stoves and all sorts of things. Are we different now? Are we different kids now? Or are we just more of a nanny state, or are neighbors too nosy?
No, I think the bottom line is that they are punishing this woman because she didn't do what they asked her to do the first time. When they went out this time, it was okay until they saw she had an infraction from before and she didn't follow through. I think they just don't like her parenting style, but it's not endangering her children. But I think they're trying to make a point, which is not fair, because they caused more trauma to the children by watching their mother get arrested than the boy walking down the street with no pants on.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that, Dr. Sophie, because all I keep thinking about is that gorgeous 14-year-old girl who was already tasked with doing a lot that day, looking after four kids as young as 3-4 years old, and doing her entire online school curriculum for the day in front of her laptop, and then basically sees this as her fault because that child got away for, 10, 15 minutes? Jeepers. Well, who among us hasn't had that happen as a grown-up, you know, with eagle eyes? So I find it just very sad and stressful for that child out of this entire picture. I find that the saddest. Thank you to both of you. Really appreciate it,
Thank
Brad
you.
Macklin and Dr. Charles Sophie. I'd love to get you back when, again, we find resolution to this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Tomorrow on Morning in America with Adrian Bankert, Nick Smith gets to peek inside the footballs that are being used in Super Bowl 56. I'm sure there are deflation inspections as we speak. Okay, face it. It is hard not to stare at your own face. And in this new world of Zoom meetings and Zoom birthdays and even Zoom court appearances, you've probably been staring at your face a lot. There's even an expression for it, Zoom face. And apparently a lot of people don't like what they see. Because the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery says there has been an explosion of tweaks and tucks across the country, at least according to their members. Plastic surgeries in 2021 were up 40% from the year before to an estimated 1.4 million surgical and non-surgical procedures by the Academy's numbers. News Nation got the scoop on a brand new survey that has yet to be released, so it's by the Academy anyway. Here to explain the phenomenon in a Banfield exclusive is Dr. Corey Maas, board certified plastic facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon and president of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. Okay, Dr. Maas, what is up? I'm reading that your members said that they performed 600 more procedures last year than the year before. What's it all about?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on, Ashley. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to be speaking with you. And on behalf of the AFPRS, I'd like to thank you and our membership. What I will tell you is that from our recent survey of all of our members representing the roughly 2,200 members across the United States, is that we did see that 40% increase during the time of the pandemic, what we've affectionately referred to as the Zoom boom. And it's probably several reasons, really, the cause from it. One of those reasons is that obviously people are staying at home more. They're looking at their monitors and seeing their faces all day long as they're working from home. They weren't able to travel. They weren't really able to do much traveling or vacation. They weren't able to go out and dine. They weren't doing very much shopping. And so what better to do than to make yourself look a little better? In addition, you know, looking at your face all day, you're able to pick apart all the subtle irregularities and find things that we might want to get fixed. So I think it really comes down to disposable income and how you might best spend it, and our patients spending it on being their best self.
Yeah, I say the job that no one's quitting at this point is the nose job. But so here's another thing I found really interesting about the Zoom correlation. And the pandemic correlation is the mask wearing. We're starting to get really used to focusing on people's eyes, maybe in a way we never did before. And I think that you and your members noticed that eye surgeries are up.
Yeah, eye surgeries were up almost 40%. And I'd have to add back into one of the reasons, especially with facial plastic surgery, which is our area of expertise, and of course our mantra is to trust your face to a specialist, a facial plastic surgeon, is that while you're wearing a mask, anything, almost everything that you can do except the eyes on the face, lips and the lower face and facelift are all areas that can be easily covered with a mask and a scarf. So there's another reason why people can move forward and do procedures during the time of the pandemic.
So a lot of these procedures, because you call them surgical and non-surgical, and I always assume that the fillers and the Botox are the non-surgical, are those up the most? Because those are, you know, far less expensive than the surgeries, and they can give you like almost an instant effect without any downtime. Or are you seeing it up across the board? People are going under the knife and saying, just give me all you got.
Well, it's both. It's absolutely up, and it's up more with the non-surgical, as you mentioned, cosmetic injectable types of procedures like Botox, which can really open the eye, lift the eyebrows, stop the frown lines. And really, as you mentioned, if you're wearing a mask, that's the sort of mirror to the soul anyway. But that's where we see the best improvements in terms of the non-invasive procedures, which also include things like lasers and radio frequency. So there are more than just the injectables. There's also the newer energy-based devices, many of which are non-invasive and have minimal downtime. But really, across the board, we've seen this. It's just as easy to cover a post-operative rhinoplasty patient with a mask or lower facelift patient with a mask as it is any of the other procedures, except the eyes. They still have recovery periods, but they're quite short. Usually people are back to normal health and normal social activities, to the extent you can call anything right. We're doing now normal, within about 10 days.
Of course. Well, Dr. Corey Maas, thank you so much from the American Academy of Facial and Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. Those details are going to be released right after this show. So go on Google and read about it. Thank you so much, Doctor. Appreciate it. Every month I sit down with leaders in the broadcast industry for a free mentoring session called Rising Tide, The Value of Mentoring Others. And today, Lisa Ling was the VIP mentor answering questions. She's the host of This Is Life on CNN and the executive producer. And she's host of Takeout on HBO Max and executive producer. And she offered up some pretty painful insights to the attendees today on what it's like being Asian American right now in the age of COVID, where attacks against her community have steeply increased.
What is the most difficult part of being an AAPI journalist during the rise in violence and vitriol towards the AAPI community? How should local news organizations address the situation?
It's been horrifying. It's been terrible. It's been terrifying to be an Asian American at all right now. But as someone with a bit of a profile, I've just felt compelled to use my platform to speak out against it. There has been a pattern of scapegoating Asian people in this country that spans more than a century, which is, again, why it's so essential for me and for people who have a bit of a profile to keep continuing to, you know, beat that drum.
Lisa told the attendees that when she was on the daytime TV program The View, she received some of the best advice in her career about mental health and self-care from Joy Behar. You should know as well that my next guest in the series is Mika Brzezinski. She's co-host of Morning Joe on MSNBC. She's coming up on March 23rd, 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So jump on. Just Google Ashley Banfield and Rising Tide, or you can go to newsnationnow.com/Rising Tide. Get a free invitation and then join us. And you can even submit a question for Mika. Thanks for being here tonight, everybody. I'll see you right back here tomorrow.